Today is Thursday, August 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Members of Parliament met in Beirut today, the first time since Lebanon's government resigned.
Well, the Lebanese Parliament convened in an open session on Thursday, August 13, and declared a state of emergency in Beirut.
Plus, now that Joe Biden has picked his running mate, what challenges face the Trump campaign?
Does the Trump campaign try to fire up its own base and scare off moderates, or does it try to depress the Democratic base?
And how scientists plan to bring back a rhino. We'll have these stories and more next. Lebanese security forces deployed heavily in Beirut Thursday, stopping protesters from reaching a conference center where members of parliament began meeting for the first time since the catastrophic chemical explosion last week that killed 172 people. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter George Eade in Beirut to get the latest as protesters continue calling for change.
Well, the Lebanese parliament convened in an open session on Thursday, August 13, and declared a state of emergency in Beirut. What does a state of emergency mean? It actually grants the army exceptional powers over civilian matters and the city's security matters and all armed units, including the internal forces and all other security forces in Beirut. According to this legislative decree, the army during a state of emergency will have the power to try civilians in military courts for crimes related to breach of security, prohibit gatherings it deems a threat to security, shut down sites of assembly, set curfews, censor media, impose house arrests, enter homes at any given time for security purposes, issue fines, and deport suspects who pose a security threat. The Speaker of the Parliament had also called for Thursday's session in order to question the minister on the blast. However, with the cabinet's resignation, it was no longer possible. The session opened with a moment of silence for the more than 171 civilians killed in the blast. And we witnessed also the resignation of 8 parliament members, which was immediately accepted and confirmed by Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri.
The measures that were enacted seem more directed towards the protests that are taking place throughout Beirut and Lebanon in response to the blast, rather than looking more into the root cause of it.
Well, some of the people in Lebanon and political entities and activists have seen these measures as measures against the protests and against the media, because we have seen political entities, and especially the Free Patriotic Movement, that is the party that the president came from, they actually stated that some media outlets are going beyond freedom of expression and something that is against the protests.
Speaking of these protests, in terms of getting exactly what they want, systemic change in Lebanon, have they been able to galvanize any sort of cohesive movement to move toward that outcome?
Well, number one on the list was the resignation of the cabinet. So far, this has been achieved, but we cannot expect more than that. Until now, the explosion has fueled a lot of outrage and protests against the top political leaders and led to the resignation of the government Monday. However, now the cabinet is now the caretaker capacity. We don't have any signs that something cohesive or something that big is ready to change the political scene. Even the resignations that were presented by parliament members were not enough to break the parliament and call for early elections. So early elections were also number two on the list for protesters. I think we'd have to wait for the developments to see anything solid happening in Beirut in terms of drastic change.
George Eade reports from Beirut, Lebanon. The United Nations is preparing an appeal to cover the enormous emergency and acute humanitarian needs of hundreds of thousands of survivors from the explosion last week. Lisa Schlein has that part of the story.
The magnitude and destructive impact of the blast is only now becoming clear. A rapid UN assessment of 55 primary health care centers finds 37% have sustained moderate to serious damage, and less than half can still provide full routine health care. The size of the disaster has created a humanitarian crisis. Getting to grips with the immediate and long-term needs is likely to run into the billions of dollars. Spokesman for the Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says UN agencies are in the process of estimating the costs.
We should expect a flash appeal in the coming days for the humanitarian response in Beirut, and that, of course, will come with a price tag. It will be a lot of money, and it will be even more in the medium and longer term.
A number of UN agencies, including the World Food Program, UN Children's Fund, and World Health Organization, have issued preliminary appeals running into hundreds of millions of dollars. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says his agency urgently needs $76 million as a stopgap measure to provide essential medical supplies and to restore damaged health facilities.
As always, the immediate response is addressing trauma and emergency medical needs, but it's also clear that major humanitarian crisis is also evolving, with hundreds of people, 100,000 of people who are displaced from their homes and urgent support for shelter and food. The displacement of so many people also risk accelerating the spread of COVID-19 and the outbreak of other diseases, including other respiratory and waterborne diseases.
WHO reports 6,812 cases of coronavirus, including 80 deaths in Lebanon. Jazarevich says the likelihood of spread of the disease is great, as physical distancing, hand washing, and other protective measures are difficult to enforce in the context of the current chaotic situation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new coronavirus outbreak that prompted New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern to put the city of Auckland under a new lockdown is growing. Among the world's 20.6 million total confirmed infections, including nearly 750,000 deaths, New Zealand has one of the lowest numbers in either category, with just 1,589 cases and 22 deaths. In the United States, another collegiate athletic conference is postponing its fall sports schedule due to the pandemic, and one of the world's top golf tournaments, the Masters, will be played this year with no spectators. It's the third major U.S. golf match to be fan-free. Now, in late March, COVID-19 survivor Diana Barrett founded a grassroots movement called Survivor Corps with a two-part mission. First, it would mobilize COVID-19 survivors to donate their antibody-rich plasma to those who were infected. And second, Survivor Corps volunteers would participate in scientific research to better understand and develop treatments. The group also developed an online forum where survivors could share their experiences and advice. 5 months and millions of infections later, doctors now deal with the debilitating long-term symptoms the novel coronavirus can cause in those who are no longer contagious. VOA's Adam Phillips asked Barrett for an update, both on the lessons learned and the gaps that remain.
We have learned so much since last we spoke. When we spoke last, we thought it was a respiratory disease. We now understand it's a clotting disease, which is why it's affecting the brain and the heart and the kidneys and all of the other organs. And we thought that it only affected the elderly and the immunocompromised, but we are all extremely vulnerable to this disease. There's nobody who is safe from it. And we now know it's airborne. That changes things dramatically.
What else have you learned?
That COVID is having a long-term impact on people's bodies and on children's bodies as well. But the real issue is that as a global community, we are tracking infections, tracking hospitalizations, and tracking morbidity. However, the vast majority of people who are infected with COVID, and we are now at over 5 million infections in the United States, are being actively told to not seek any medical help whatsoever, unless they cannot breathe, in which case they are to go to the emergency room. So the vast majority of people infected with COVID are not being tracked by the medical community. Their experiences have gone basically unrecorded, and they are suffering 5-6 months into the virus with debilitating symptoms.
You quoted a CDC report from a couple of weeks ago that says that 1 in 3 people who've been infected with the coronavirus still have long-term symptoms of the disease even after 14 days.
Absolutely. And the people they are referring to are not the people who are hospitalized. We're talking about the people who recovered at home, like me, never saw their doctor. So the vast majority of people infected with COVID are not being tracked by the medical community.
Since March 24th, when you started, you've amassed a huge repository of anecdotal reports from coronavirus survivors.
We have over 90,000 members recording their experiences in real time, and we're able to take that information and translate that data into information that can inform clinicians on what to look for in helping these people who are having long-term symptoms and helping those patients whose doctors are diagnosing them with anxiety, as opposed to recognizing that they are having very serious medical complications, neurological issues, tachycardia, COVID onset diabetes, hair loss, chronic fatigue, shortness of breath, you name it. There doesn't seem to be a body system that is not affected by this virus. And the doctors are flummoxed. And trying to compare it with other post-viral reactions. But these are not mild symptoms. These are quite intense. The scary thing is the people who are suffering the most are the ones who are in their 20s and 30s, who had no underlying conditions, were never hospitalized, and now 5 months in post-COVID, they cannot climb a flight of stairs.
It's a delicate thing, getting doctors who rely only on data-driven studies to take even a mountain of anecdotal reports very seriously.
You're absolutely right. And that is really informed our mission, creating an educational feedback loop between patients and the medical and scientific community. And we are also actually launching Recovery Corps, which will be a longitudinal study done in coordination with Columbia University. It will track COVID patients over years, tracking their antibody levels and tracking them symptomatically to see how their symptoms evolve and hopefully resolve over time. But unfortunately, we are going to need to have post-COVID care centers throughout the country.
Diana Behrendt is the founder of Survivor Corps, a global grassroots movement connecting COVID-19 survivors with medical, scientific, and research communities. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. Still to come.
Malaysia's last rhino died in November after years of failed breeding attempts. All that's left of the local species are some skin, eggs, and tissue samples. And scientists are using that with experimental stem cell technology to bring back the Malaysian Sumatran rhinoceros.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA reports that its Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, ended its two-year primary mission and began its extended mission on July 4th. TESS, launched in April 2018, has been seen by many as NASA's exoplanet-hunting successor to the Spitzer Space Telescope, whose 15-year mission ended in January 2020. During the first year of its mission, TESS observed and imaged 13 24-by-96-degree bands of the southern sky and did the same with the northern sky in its second primary mission year. NASA says TESS discovered 66 confirmed exoplanets and 2,100 exoplanet candidates that are in the process of being confirmed within the first 2 years of its operation. For its extended mission, members of the TESS team have initiated new improvements to how it gathers and processes its observational data. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy has this update on the Japanese bulk carrier that struck a coral reef off the coast of Mauritius and leaked 1,000 tons of oil.
The owners of the oil tanker causing a massive oil spill off the coast of Mauritius says that most of the oil still aboard has now been secured and removed. The MC Wakashio has already spilled an estimated 1,000 tons of oil into the sea, but 2,000 tons were thought to still be on the ship before the announcement from Nagashiki Shipping, a Japanese company. Spokesman Yoshinori Fukushima said, quote, "I heard the collection is almost over, but it is hard to tell if there is absolutely no oil left on the ship." Mauritian Prime Minister Pravind Jugnauth said on Tuesday that the MV Waikashio was expected to break apart, raising concerns of a major ecological disaster. Oil from the stricken vessel has reached some of the Indian Ocean islands' most pristine beaches, threatening corals, other local wildlife, and the country's tourism industry. Volunteers intensified their cleanup efforts Wednesday, donning protective suits to shield themselves from the toxic slick. Former colonial ruler France has said it will assist Mauritius with the cleanup, and Japan said it will send experts to help. The International Maritime Organization is providing technical advice. Japan P&I Club, the only organization in Japan that underwrites protection and indemnity insurance for ocean-going vessels and coastal ships, said it had yet to estimate the cost of the cleanup.
That was Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy. The announcement of Joe Biden's running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, appears to be stirring excitement among Democratic donors. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports on big numbers for the campaign's coffers.
Joe Biden raised $26 million for his presidential campaign in the 24 hours that followed his announcement that Senator Kamala Harris of California would be his running mate. The campaign says that sum more than doubled their previous record. Act Blue, an online fundraising arm for the left, reported taking in almost $11 million in the hours after the Harris announcement. Harris joined Biden in Delaware on Wednesday for their first fundraiser together as running mates.
I know that we're going to get this thing done, but we're going to have to fight for it.
The Biden campaign hopes that haul is the beginning of a prolific fundraising push in the final stretch before Election Day. The campaign has an aggressive schedule of online fundraisers planned for Harris. Harris already has a robust network of donors from her native California. The flood of money generated by the Harris announcement is signaling enthusiasm among Democrats following the selection of the first black woman on a major party's presidential ticket. Jennifer King, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump is the incumbent and is trailing presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden in national opinion surveys. The AP's Sagar Morghani has that part of the story.
In her debut appearance after joining the Biden ticket, Kamala Harris aggressively went after the president, saying there's a reason the coronavirus has hit America harder than other nations.
It's because of Trump's failure to take it seriously from the start.
Saying this is what happens when we elect a guy who just isn't up for the job.
I think she's going to be a big failure.
The president's been struggling to find a coherent message about the Democratic ticket. Does the Trump campaign try to fire up its own base and scare off moderates by calling Joe Biden and Kamala Harris radical socialists? Or does it try to depress the Democratic base by arguing Biden and Harris are not liberal enough? He's resorted to sexist criticism, calling Harris nasty. Sagar Morghani, Washington.
The Israeli military says it has struck Hamas militant sites in the Gaza Strip in response to the continued launches of explosives-laden balloons from the Palestinian territory into Israel. The military said Thursday's targets included a compound used by Hamas's naval force and underground infrastructure and observation posts. There is no immediate report of injuries on either side. Hundreds of people are back on the streets of Belarus's capital protesting for the fifth day in a row against an election that they say was rigged to extend the power of the country's authoritarian leader and crack down on rallies that followed the vote. Thousands of people have rallied all across Belarus since Sunday, demanding a recount of the ballot that gave President Alexander Lukashenko a landslide victory with 80% of the votes. Police deployed to break up the protests used batons, stun grenades, tear gas, and rubber bullets. Scientists are pinning their hopes on experimental stem cell technology to bring back the Malaysian variant of the Sumatran rhinoceros. Reuters reporter Soraya Ali brings us that story.
Malaysia's last rhino died in November after years of failed breeding attempts. All that's left of the local species are some skin, eggs, and tissue samples. And scientists are using that with experimental stem cell technology to bring back the Malaysian Sumatran rhinoceros. The process works by using cells from the dead rhinos to produce sperm and eggs. That should yield test tube babies that can be implanted into a living animal or a closely related species, like a horse. It's similar to the plan for the African northern white rhino, which has seen some success. Japanese researchers have also grown teeth and organs, such as pancreas and kidneys, using embryonic stem cells from rats and mice in efforts to grow replacement human organs. But scientists leading this research say it's still far from producing a whole new animal. They warn that even if it did work, the animal's lack of genetic diversity could pose a threat to its long-term survival. Indonesian scientist Arif Bodenyo is among those helping in Malaysia.
The research is not going to end. We will continue to work on it. I think there is an opportunity here, even if it does take 5, 10 or 20 years. I don't know. But it has succeeded in animal labs, so that means there's a chance of success in Malaysia.
The Sumatran species was declared extinct in the wild in Malaysia in 2015. The smallest among the world's rhinos, it had once roamed across Asia, but hunting and forest clearance reduced its numbers to just 80 in neighboring Indonesia. The last two rhinos, 25-year-old Iman and 30-year-old Tam, died just 6 months apart in a nature reserve on Borneo Island last year. Efforts to get the pair to breed had failed. For now, Iman's hide will be preserved and put on display alongside Tam in a Borneo museum.
Saroya Ali reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For years, the U.S. has made a simple request to the People's Republic of China to stop its criminal, coercive, and nefarious activities in the United States. And for years, the Chinese government has refused to do so. In light of its intransigence, the U.S. State Department has shuttered the Chinese consulate in Houston, Texas, over alleged efforts to illegally transfer medical research from institutions in the area. To persuade more than 50 researchers, professors, and academics in the area to turn over information to Chinese institutions, and to pressure Chinese citizens in the United States whom the Chinese government considers political rivals to return to their homeland. The Houston consulate's activities went well over the line of what the United States is willing to accept from the Foreign Diplomatic Corps. The administration's decision to order the closure of the PRC consulate in Houston was just the latest in a series of actions the United States has taken to rein in the aggressive behavior of the CCP. For years, Beijing has enjoyed free and open access to U.S. society while not offering reciprocal access to U.S. diplomats in China. This is unacceptable. But it isn't only in the United States where the Chinese missions abuse their welcome. Indeed, the theft of intellectual property and spying is a global threat. A recent 11-count indictment handed down by the U.S. Justice Department alleges that Li Xiaoyu and Deng Xiaoxi conducted a hacking campaign lasting more than 10 years to the present, targeting companies in countries with high technology industries, including the United States, Australia, Belgium, Germany, Japan, Lithuania, the Netherlands, Spain, South Korea, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. Each new indictment exposes how the PRC has relied on illegal, covert, coercive, corrupt behavior to try to impose its will on the world to gain unfair advantage in its economic and diplomatic relationships. The recent actions taken by the State Department vis-a-vis the PRC are an effort to place the U.S.-China relationship on the solid foundation of fairness, respect, and reciprocity. President Trump has said enough to the CCP's unacceptable behavior in the United States. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made this point during his recent European travels. We are setting out clear expectations for how the Chinese Communist Party is going to behave. And when they don't, we're going to take actions that protect the American people, protect our security, our national security, and also protect our economy and jobs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.